Well, that was a very interesting California report on substance abuse, and I very much enjoyed Paul's news tonight, especially on education in the prison systems. Good evening. It's 6:59 and 40 seconds. You're listening to KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah, K201 HR 88.1 FM Fort Bragg, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, listener-supported community radio, and we also stream on the web at www.kzyx.org. Well, good evening. I am your host for Education Now, Athena Melville, and we're just getting ready for our show, so let's go ahead and get started. And here we go with the music.
Are on the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh.
Well, good evening and welcome to Education Now. I'm your host, Athena Melville, and tonight on Education Now, we welcome Dr. Jonathan Melville, who returns to Education Now for a focus on women in science, the facts. Dr. John holds a BA in psychology and biology, a PhD in zoology, and completed work as a postdoctoral research associate in neuroscience. He's been our guest on Education Now as we explored global warming and the assault on science that we've seen in our country, mythology, psychology, and again when he joined us with his students to reflect on their environmental work doing community service in Mendocino County. Tonight, we welcome him back with the question, what does the research tell us, Dr. John, about human females and their abilities in the sciences? Hello, John.
Hello.
Could you speak up a bit?
Hello?
Hello, John. We're getting kind of an echo. Hello?
I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
Yes, but we are getting an echo.
I'm sorry, I can't do much about the phone that I'm using.
Okay, well, we'll just do the best that we can. So, John, why don't you just get started? Tell us, what does the research say about human females and their mental abilities in the sciences?
It says that there really is no difference. Dr. Summers, was president of Harvard University a while back, brought up this sort of assumption that... that if you look at the extreme end of mathematical ability, that there tend to be like more men than women, but that isn't related to like average ability in math or anything like that. And essentially he turned that into, well, maybe that's just why men are better scientists or better in the sciences than women. And if you look at the real data, it's just he is truly making or was making a mountain out of a molehill. And so what I did is I went out and I did some research and read several articles and developed a series of lectures that I gave at Wartburg College and to some other classes that were on campus on what I would call sex in the brain, and really just talking about are there any sex differences in the brain between men and women, and the answer is yes, and then does that amount to anything when it comes to intellectual ability, IQ, or mathematical ability, and I would say no. And basically, I sort of got interested in this topic a long time ago when I was getting my undergraduate degree, because there was a debate that happened between a professor of mine named Dr. Brumbaugh and a woman in my class named Donna Ashizawa, who was a returning student, and they got into an argument about why there weren't women in science. And Dr. Brumbaugh basically said, well, it's basically because, you know, men are just sort of a little bit smarter than women. And Donna, of course, took issue with that. And being trained as a good scientist, I thought, well, you know, if I'm a real scientist, I need to look at all of the assumptions that are out there. And so I looked around at all of my classmates, and the majority of them that were doing excellent in the biology program just happened to be women. And the majority of people that did excellent at my high school just happened to be women. And then the majority of people that did excellent in graduate school, oh wait, they just happened to be women. And so I just thought that there's got to be something wrong here, but I thought I would just delve into it a little bit. A lot of this dates back to what is called the brain size problem. Women do have smaller brains than men, even when comparing or controlling for body size. And a long time ago, the French decided that this was the reason why women just, you know, they just had to be stupid. And there was Gustave Le Bon in 1879 who said, in the most intelligent races, as among the Parisians, this is a quote, there are a large number of women whose brains are closer to the size of those of gorillas than to most developed male brains. This inferiority is so obvious that no one can contest it for a moment. Only its degree is worth discussion.
Oh, my God.
And, I mean, and you would think that's you know, back in 1879. And I thought, well, this has kind of gone away, you know. But in just talking to other scientists that I knew, the dean at Wartburg College, she talked about sexism that she had to deal with in the 50s. When she was getting her degree, about how she couldn't go into certain buildings without wearing a dress. It was just required. And I thought, well, you know, that's the 50s. And then I talked to another friend of mine named Sally, who in the 60s was told that she couldn't major in biology because she was a woman. And I thought, well, that's still, you know, quite a bit ago. And then I remember talking to my thesis advisor, or not my thesis advisor, my postdoctoral advisor, who was told that she couldn't go and study in the in Antarctica because, well, she was a woman and she just couldn't handle it. And then once again, I thought, well, you know, that's still a long time ago. And then when I was a college professor, one of my good friends, Dr. Peer, was told that she could not be a doctor at the University of Missouri in the 80s because she was a woman, and women just weren't doctors. So, and still I thought, okay, well, that's still the 80s. Maybe things have changed. A good friend of mine, Deirdre Henriquez, Deirdre, was basically told in the 90s at Old Dominion University in Virginia that women just shouldn't be biology majors. And so this is still something that's quite pervasive. It's not as out in the open the type of, like, sexism that exists. And really, there have been, they're sort of what I would call the gender war has become part of this culture war that's gone on between, quote unquote, the left and the right. And the media has kind of picked up on it and decided that they need to bring in experts to talk about, you know, the brain. And so these are just some examples of the mainstream media, what they talk about. So, like, ABC News did a whole special on how scientists have found sex differences in the brain. There's this controversial research revealing differences between men and women, and this is by Amanda Onion in, like, 2005, you know, where Harvard University President Lawrence H. Summers created a maelstrom when he suggested recently that innate differences in sex may explain why fewer women succeed in science and math careers, and they try to link these two. And what I'm trying to bring up is there any truth to the idea that men's and women's brains are, in fact, different? And the answer is yes. But that doesn't mean that that explains why fewer women appear to succeed in math and science. I mean, if you assume that a big brain, large brain, means you're going to be smart, then yes. But tons of research says that that's just not the case.
Yes, John?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. There was the new fossil hominid remains. Is that what you're talking about? And the
Well, I'm going to get there. It's one of these things that sometimes anthropologists will find the brain of a hominid or an ancient human, and they'll say, "Oh, this thing had a huge brain, Therefore, it must have been incredibly smart." And what if that were the case, then Neanderthals would be much smarter than us because their brain size, on average, was much larger than Homo sapiens.
Right.
And no one likes to talk about that.
That's right.
And there was also a very, very small hominid that was found off the island of Flores in Indonesia that had an incredibly small brain but had incredibly complex tools, and people are arguing about whether or not it could have had some type of language. And so this whole idea that, you know, absolute brain size is related to inherent intelligence is completely erroneous. I mean, my favorite thing that I like to say is, I used to bring up is, you know, if you can imagine Adam and Eve standing next to each other, and, you know, Adam is saying, "I'm smarter than you," and you have Eve holding an apple, you know, saying, "Of course you are. How about an apple?" I mean, mythologically, you know, we know that this is not the case. That, I mean, any young man that's gone out on the dating scene when you turn about 16, you know that the women are smarter than you. I'm sorry, that's just something that you have to deal with for a while.
Well, you know, John, they used to measure the baby's head after birth, and the babies with a larger head got a higher score. And I can remember just being so irate about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's just interesting because everybody sort of feels like they're qualified to weigh in on this. Like, there's a book out there called Taking Sex Differences Seriously by Stephen Rhodes. And his basic assumption is because men and women are virtually interchangeable, men should do an equal share of domestic and child-rearing work so that women can complete equally outside the home. He basically says that that's like the liberal agenda, and if we can show that there really are differences, then that is, you know, not the case.
Well, you know, your grandfather used to say, my father and your grandfather, "What kind of a man, Athena, can't cook? What kind of a man can't take care of himself?" Now, that's an older generation man who really believed that he was not a man if he couldn't cook, if he couldn't take care of himself and was dependent on a woman. So I don't know, you know, I think that there are men out there who have known all along that they want to be whole people, and they want women to be whole people.
Oh, yes, no. What I'm saying is that there are people out there that are writing books that just aren't qualified. Like Stephen Rhodes, who wrote this book, he's not a neuroscientist, he's not a biologist, he's not a psychologist. He's taught public policy at the University of Virginia for 30 years. And so I just always wondered how he became qualified to talk about true differences between men and women. There's another really, really popular book by this person named Simon Baron Cohen, who was a professor of developmental psychopathology. And his book is called The Essential Difference. And there's this picture of this, you know, young man looking, you know, like he's thinking very hard on the top, and a woman who has this very sort of scared, empathetic look down below. And he divides the male brain into systematizing and the female brain into empathetic. You know, these are the two key differences. And as a neuroscientist, what I would say is anytime anybody tries to make something simplistic, they're not really getting at the truth. And that said, any scientist that says the truth in their, you know, title about like how the brain works or anything like that, you should be very skeptical, because we really have no idea how the brain works. The title of this book, The Essential Difference, the next title is The Truth About the Male and Female Brain. And, like, we really don't know the truth. The best book that's out there, if your listeners are interested, that I found is by Cynthia Darlington, and it's called The Female Brain, and that was published in 2002. But this is a review of, like, real scientific studies on brain differences between men and women. It's called The Female Brain. And, of course, it's out of print and very hard to get. Another really good book on this topic is Natalie Angier's Woman and Intimate Geography. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer. That's an incredible book. There was a book that was published in 2006 called The Female Brain by Louanne Brezadine, who's a doctor. And this was actually a really, really good book. I would invite anybody that's interested to go out and read it. And it's also meant for the general public. It's not like a bunch of science studies. I can keep on going from here. Typically what I would do is say, you know, the brain has different parts, it has different pieces, and then talk about the different parts of the brain and then the studies that are actually out there. You think is that a good idea or a good place to go?
Well, yes, or you could just tell us what the conclusions of those studies are at this point in time in the research. Are the conclusions that women don't do and cannot do as well in science as men? Or are the conclusions that...
There are some real differences in parts of the brain between men and women. The issue, though, is that those parts of the brain that are different have nothing really to do with cognitive abilities. There's things like the hypothalamus, which is involved in hormonal regulation and things like that, and parts of the lower brain that are different. But when it comes to what we would call where intelligence resides, that would be in the cortex or the outside of the brain, the very, very outside of the brain. And there are some differences there, but it's really interesting how it plays out. Like I said before, men really do have a larger brain, even when compared to body size, and they actually have probably more brain cells. And what's interesting is a lot of people have tried to say, well, you can correlate this with SAT scores, like SAT math scores. If you look at them by race and sex, you would find that white men do the best, followed by white women, and then you have black men and then black women. And what's interesting, though, is that what a lot of people won't tell you is that there are some very serious issues and problems with the SAT. One is that the SAT is not a test of inherent intelligence. The SAT is a test that predicts how well we think freshmen will do in their first year of college.
And I know, also the test is very biased towards experiences that you've had in life.
Yes, and that's one thing that I'll bring up later about some of these tests is that there have been what they would call, in some of these tests, there are some questions just in the way that they're worded that typically men will do better or women will do better on. And for the longest time, like in standard IQ tests and things like that, women always did better in verbal, like on the SAT. Hold on for a minute here. I think I actually have that here.
Well, John...
Here we go. Yeah, women tended to do better on the verbal portion of the SAT, and then what happened was is they went through on that verbal section of the SAT, and they controlled for that effect. They said, well, we need to ask more questions about sports. We need to ask more questions about experiences that men have had. And lo and behold, when you do that sort of gender balancing, all of a sudden the SAT scores and verbal become equal. And that type of gender balancing in the SAT and math has never been done. It's just never been done. And some people would say, well, you know, that's really not a big deal. Like, I mean, if you're trying to solve a quadratic equation, does it really matter? And I would say, well, a big portion of the SAT consists of word problems. And there's been no sort of gender balancing there. And that could be one of those issues.
Well, way back when I was doing research on the SATs, what I found was that they were they were designed, the research I found was they were designed really to keep blacks out of the military. And so, you know, there's so much bias in the tests, you know, to they're geared towards experience and culture of a white male, and that's why they do better on them. That's my opinion anyway, John. Are you going to talk about softball girls?
Yeah, I'll do that. I'll get to that. That one of the things while we're talking about, like, the SAT and things like that, there's another test called the PISA, the Program for International Student Assessment. And that the test was done back in, like, 2003, and in some ways this is a much better test of, like, sort of abilities of people in math and science. And another important thing is it's done globally. And so if you were going to assume that for some reason men are better at women in science and math, then you would have to assume that would hold throughout the entire world. Like, you would always find, no matter what culture you were in, that, you know, men would do better than women. And really what we found is that in Iceland, females outperform males in math, which is why maybe women should have been running the banking system in Iceland in the past couple of years. In three other countries, females perform as well as males in math. Three other countries, not in the U.S. right now. And really what that indicates is that the math gap that we see is really a cultural gap for whatever reason. There's some cultural bias. Put another way, if it were biological, if it were truly biological, then males would always outperform females in math, no matter what. Currently, there is no science gap. Like, if you look at the PISA test throughout, you know, the world, this was done, like, back in 2003. There is no gender gap when it comes to science, for whatever reason.
Thank you, John. You're listening to KZYX. This is Education Now. I'm your host, Athena Melville, on the line with Dr. Jonathan Melville, and we're discussing women and science, the facts. Go ahead, John.
Oh, no. What's interesting for me as a neuroscientist is that when you actually look at the brains, you look at the brains of women and men, there really are some interesting differences, even in what we call the cortex, which is the outside of the brain. But what's interesting is that women tend to have more what we call gyrifications, or they tend to have more folds, or almost like more surface area in different parts of the brain. So even though the brain is actually smaller when you control for body mass, it's actually a little bit more complex in some areas. And so if you go back and you look at basic IQ scores, and this is a study that was done this is actually based in 1991, where they actually looked at brain volume and gender. You find that women do have a smaller brain size and males do have a larger brain size, and that this is statistically significant. They really do have a larger brain. But when you look at IQ scores, there is no statistically significant difference between men and women, period. There have been lots of reported differences in the brains of men and women. Like, you might hear that men have more gray matter, which is the sort of cell bodies and synaptic connections, that women have more white matter, which is the tracts or connecting regions in the brain, that the cells that make up the brain, that men have more differences, and that there's different areas in the brain that are all connected, these dendrites, or what we call dendritic density, that women have greater dendritic density. And then there's this thing called gyrification or folds, and there have been reports that women have greater, you know, folding areas. The interesting thing is that all of these assumptions have been contested with the exception of two, which is that women do have greater amounts of white matter, and these are the areas of the brain that connect to each other, and they have more folds in some certain areas. If you're like me and you're a neuroscientist, you think all this stuff is really, really interesting and you can talk about it forever. But are there really any differences in cognitive abilities? And there tend to be a few. Men tend to be better at what we call spatial learning or spatial learning tasks. So, like, looking at an object and imagining where it is in space, or imagining rotating it, men tend to be better at that than women. But when it comes to perceptual speed, like the ability to add things up in their head or do things like that, women are better than men for some reason. And what's interesting is that some of these things are not what I would call genetically hardwired. Some of them are related to testosterone levels. So, like spatial learning, men that have low testosterone for some weird reason do really well in spatial tasks, whereas women that have higher testosterone on average do better. Now, what's interesting is that this sort of spatial learning paradigm, you know, that, oh, well, men are better at spatial learning or spatial tasks. If you look in some textbooks, there's a really amazing textbook out there that a lot of graduate students use called Cognitive Neuropsychology, where they talk about, well, if men are better at spatial learning, and even male rats are better at certain spatial learning tasks, they then say, oh, well, we should relate that to geometry, which then goes to math. And that's why, you know, men are better at these tasks. But when it really comes down to mathematical ability, we just don't see that. But you can still find these types of assumptions in textbooks. What's really interesting in some of these cases is that if you look at the animal studies, the way that they used to do these spatial learning tasks are actually kind of biased. What they used to do is and I actually noticed this when I was doing my own research, is when you're training a rat to learn its location in, like, a maze, a lot of times what you would use is a water maze. So you have to imagine a pool of water, and it's filled with, like, non-fat milk powder, so it's white. And there's a platform that the rat can learn to get out of the pool at. And rats can swim. It's not cruel to do to a rat. You drop them in the pool. They learn to swim to that position so that they can actually get out of the water and stand. And then, you know, you give them a little food reward. And what we found is when you train male and female rats to do this task, they learn really quickly how to get to that platform. Well, the way that most people would test learning, like how well an animal learned, was you remove the platform, you drop the rat in the maze, and you see how long the rat swims around the area where the platform was. So it's like, well, if it stays in the area where it could escape, that means that it learned really well. And male rats do this, like, they will circle and circle and circle and circle right where that platform was for, like, 5 minutes, 6 minutes. And what we found with female rats is that they will swim right to where that platform was, they will spin around three times, and then they will go around the edge of the pool looking for, I would say, some other way to get out. And yet, people would say, oh, the female rats didn't learn that well. And I said, no, they learned that the platform isn't there and they need to find another way to get out. The male rats still think that somehow magically that platform will appear. The female rats are actually smarter. But when you look at the actual research, no one's really picking up on this or saying anything about this. Another big problem with gender studies is that nobody really controls for what I call experience. And this is something that I ran into in my class at Warburg College, where there's this assumption that men are always better at throwing than women. Like, they're more accurate at a throwing task. And a lot of these studies involve college students. Well, I just happened to want to repeat this type of study in my class. And there's a special type of throwing that you can do called prism adaptation, which is the brain's ability to adapt. So if you put a pair of special goggles on an individual that shifts their vision, your brain will automatically adjust, almost unconsciously, and you'll begin to throw correctly after several throws. And there's lots of research that says, oh, men are much better at this task than women. Well, when I was teaching neuroscience, I had, you know, almost all women in my class and some men, and we didn't see this at all. In fact, we almost saw the exact opposite. And what I found in looking at, I went back then and said, okay, how many of you in my class are on the softball team? Because it's a smaller arts college. And it turned out that I had like half of the college softball team in my class.
So then when I took the women that played softball and divided them up, their scores on this visual task, from women who had never played any sports at all, now we saw a statistically significant difference. If I compared the women that had never done any sports, period, ever, they were worse than men. But women that had grown up playing softball or had played it for years, you know, they had learned how to throw a ball, were just as good as men. And yet you never really see any of this sort of, you know, data that looks at, well, you know, what about experience? What we really know about the brain, if we know anything about the brain, is that it's incredibly plastic. It's incredibly plastic. There are these amazing critical periods, you know, in early development for language, for motor control, for lots of different tasks. And so it just seems amazing to me that the people that are doing these studies don't do things like say, well, you know, we need to see if this is, you know, related to just experience. If women, you know, are exposed to the same sort of culture environment or this, even just the same environment when it comes to athletics, I mean, in some cases, they're going to perform just as well. Maybe they're not going to be as strong as men, but still, in some tasks, they're going to perform just as well.
Well, thank you, John. John, we need to slow down a little bit here and take a little music break, and
okay.
I want to ID the station. You're listening to Education Now, and with me, Athena Melville, and our guest, Dr. Jonathan Melville, and where our focus is women in science, the facts, and it's really fun. And when I spoke to you, John, earlier. We're going to talk about who's smarter, John, your scientist wife, Sarah McBride, or you. And we want to answer that question. But first, we're going to take a little music break. And when we come back, maybe we'll open up the lines, or maybe we'll continue because there's a lot more to cover. So I asked John if he had some music that he wanted for our little break here. And he said, yes, no doubt. A track called Just a Girl by Gwen Stefani. So here we go.
Take this pink ribbon off my eyes. I'm exposed and it's no big surprise. Don't you think I know exactly where I stand? This
I'm some kind of freak, but they all seem to stare away.
Well, there you have it. That was great. Thank you for recommending that song, Dr. John.
Sure.
Well, shall we open the lines up now, or shall we continue before opening the lines?
Well, let me just talk about a few things, and then let's open the lines.
All righty. Go for it.
Okay, because what I think really is happening is that when you look at academia, it takes a really long time for women really to land in those positions and show up there. And what's really interesting is if you even look at the college that I was at, Wartburg College, I left. The person that replaced me is a woman. The two people that they hired while I was there were women. And if you even look at the chemistry department after I left, they've hired three women. So the department, like specifically in chemistry, had no women in it. And now it's close to 50%. And the biology department had one woman in it, one full tenured professor in it, and now they've got, you know, four. And really, I just think it's going to take time. I mean, if you look back in 1976 at the number of men that to comparison of men to women that were in college, the student body, 60% of the student body in 76. You know, overall, on average, were men, and less than 50% were women. And almost the exact opposite is true now. Men make up about, just over 40%, and women make, over 50%. If you look at, back in 1970, the number of women that were going into these sort of, top-line professions like law school, medicine, dentistry, veterinary medicine, pharmacy, they were all less than 10% with the exception of pharmacy, which was 20% for women. Now if you look at all of those things, as far as 2002 goes, women make up 50% of the lawyers that are in law school. In medicine, they're over 40%. That's, a fourfold increase. In dentistry, it's, 35%. In veterinary medicine, it's approaching 70%, and in pharmacy, it's approaching 70%. So huge gains have been made. The other thing that I think, too, is that people don't understand sometimes is that really to get ahead in academia, there's this thing that we refer to called pedigree, which is, where did you go to school? Where did you get your PhD? Where did you get your bachelor's degree? And those things really can make a difference, in addition to how many papers you've published and things like that. And so I think it's actually really interesting if you think about when do you think the first woman was admitted to Harvard Medical School, one of the best medical programs in the country? What year?
I have no idea.
1945. So that means that women have only been in one of the best medical schools in the country, Harvard Medical School, for what? Just over, 60 years or something? It's really not that long in terms of, And so this is why I think maybe, Dr. or Larry Summers, who, was the president of Harvard, he just didn't get this. I mean, Harvard has actually been behind the times by 3/4 of a century. The very first college to allow women into their medical school was the University of Michigan in 1870. And yet, it took, the top tier programs, almost, 60 years before they would do these things. And that just makes the problem worse. The awful thing that a lot of people don't understand is that there are a lot of really famous women scientists. It's just that as scientists, we don't refer to them by their first name. So, for me, as a zoologist and an invertebrate zoologist, there's this person named L.H. Hyman, who is the world's most prolific comparative vertebrate anatomist and invertebrate biologist. She just happens to be a woman. For those of you that are familiar with the Nobel Prize that was just given, Francois Barassounis, I can't pronounce her last name, I've been following her for years because she was one of these people that really helped discover that HIV causes AIDS. She actually discovered, HIV 1. And yet everybody probably knows the name Luc Montagnier, and Robert Gallo. And so I was just ecstatic when the Nobel Committee actually gave her the Nobel Prize for her work on this instead of Robert Gallo, because it's like things are beginning to actually shift now.
Well, I would hope so, because really, one of the reasons that, Montessori was a doctor. She was the first female physician in Italy, and yet getting her to be recognized for her ideas, like a Rousseau, for instance, is very difficult. And then what about that crick thing, remember?
One of the reasons why I got into this research, too, is because of Rosalind Franklin, who was essentially the person that did all of the, what I would call, backbreaking work, or X-ray crystallography, to find out the structure of DNA, where you had Watson and Crick, who were playing around with some models, and essentially stole her data. They were given her data by someone, and they came up with a model. And their model for how DNA is put together, there's no way they could have done it without her data. And she probably would have gotten the Nobel Prize if she had been alive at the time when it was given, but you can't get it posthumously. You can't get it after you passed away. But there are some really other really famous female scientists out there. Like the first person to discover that DNA really is genetic material was a woman. That was done with like bacteria and viruses. It's just that, once again, all we know is like Harvey and Chase. We know those two names, and no one knows that, one of the people that did that seminal work, her, first name was feminine. Another really amazing example for any biochemist out there is, or if you've gone and taken a biochemistry class, you have to learn this, we always thought it was a horrible equation, called the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation. Well, Hasselbalch is a woman. The first person to figure out there, just to find out that there were peptide receptors in the brain, was a woman. The first person to find out that there were jumping genes, was a woman. The first person that discovered there were pulsars was a woman. And so I just think it's going to take a while, or educators need to realize that it actually is important to bring up some of the history and not just talk about facts, but to actually show people. Like, what I do is it's not like I go on sort of a feminist tirade. I just show pictures. Like, when I talk about Harvey and Chase, I'll have a picture of both of them. And then someone will go, really? Wow, I didn't know that one of those researchers was a woman. I'm like, well, now you do. Or when I talk about other research, I'll show pictures. And that way it's not like I'm saying, look, you need to understand that there are women scientists, because that doesn't really work when you try to force anything on anybody. If you just show people the facts, what I mean is, if you just show them the people that have done this work and you use pictures, then it becomes, people will begin to understand that science isn't just dominated by men. There's plenty of incredibly smart women scientists. And I think really that goes throughout history. There's lots of famous women in history that we really don't talk enough about. Probably a lot of your listeners have seen the movie 300, which is the battle of the, Spartans against, Xerxes and all this great, historical stuff. There was Artemisia of Halicarnassus, was a warrior queen and a trireme commander. And after that whole battle, involving 300, there was an amazing naval battle at Salamis. And that was what determined, that's really what pushed Xerxes back and started Athens off as being a great superpower. Now, Xerxes decided not to listen to this warrior queen, and this is actually written down in the historical record, where she actually told Xerxes, like, don't go into Salamis. Don't go into that little space in there. You're going to get creamed. And she didn't fight with him. And if he had listened to her, we probably would all be speaking a completely different language, possibly. But there are lots of also just famous, amazing women in history besides Queen Elizabeth. And so I think that we need to, it's not like we need to be revisionists, but we just need to look at and understand that half of the population that's going through school, they're women. And we have to understand that it's important to talk about both genders and the accomplishments of people regardless of their gender. And we're talking about history or science. For so long, a lot of our historical record and science has only been written by men. So it's important, I think, that we need to stop, take stock, and, you know, maybe we need to talk a little bit more about some of the women in history that really have changed things, and women in science.
Well, John, you know, it's 7:45. What is it?
And that's just pretty much it. I mean, the reason why I really got into this is because I looked at all of the people that have been influential in my life as a scientist, and they're all women. I mean, every single one of them, with the exception of my PhD advisor, were women. All the people that I ask advice about in science are women. And so it just doesn't really make sense.
And your wife, Sarah, is smarter than you are, isn't she?
I think so.
Well, John, you know, the phones are ringing and we haven't even opened the lines, but we have about 4 minutes that we could. This is Education Now. Your host, Athena Melville, and we're talking with Dr. Jonathan Melville about women in science, the facts. Shall we take this phone call, John?
Sure.
Okay, here we go. Hello, caller. You're on KZYX.
Hi, what a great show, Athena. Thank you. I'm just calling to let you and your audience know that AAAUW, American Association of University Women, did a study where they showed that the social science and history books across the nation only contain 3% of the achievements of women. Of all the books' pages, only 3% of them are devoted to the achievements of women. That's why we do the Women's History Project every other year in Willits, where we take the achievements of women with Chautauqua-like characters into the classrooms of the schools of Willits, which we'll be doing this March for Women's History Month.
Oh, that's terrific.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, the thing that I used to argue with, I've actually given this talk at the AAUP, or the American Association for University Women at Wartburg College, and they were the ones that basically said, you need to give this speech or this talk to other people, and I was invited to do it at a women's studies class and at a women in science class. And when I used to sort of tease some of my women's studies people, I would say, you know, this isn't just women's history, this is our history. You know, we need to do more than just spend a month on it. We need to put it into all of the history books, all of the science books, so that it's just there. You know, it just is part of the record.
Well, I didn't give John, I didn't give our phone numbers. The phone numbers here are 895-2448, 895-2448, or if you're out of the area, 1-800-499-7117, just if you're out of the area. So let's go on, John. We have a couple of more minutes. If there's anything you didn't tell us that you want to tell us, you need to tell us now.
Well, I would say I might close with there was a saying that a scientist friend of mine said when I was interviewing for graduate school. And he basically said the easiest way, because really what we have to do is men and women need to come together to solve this problem or this issue and agree that we're all, regardless of, you know, race, creed, color, sex, or gender, we've all played an incredibly important part in the history of science, in history, etc. And the easiest way to make a man a feminist is to make him have a daughter. In my case, it's to have two nieces, because you look at them growing up and you just say, I want them to have, you know, the ability, all of the ability and opportunity that I had. And it really shouldn't matter whether they're a boy or a girl or black or white. And I think we're getting there. It's just going to take a little more time.
Well, we have another phone call. Shall we take it?
Yes, let's take it.
Hello there. You're on the air with Dr. John Melville.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was trying to reach Paul Hansen.
Oh, you need to call the news line.
What number is that?
I don't know, but if you call 895-2448 or 895-2324, 895-2324, I bet they'll give you a hint there.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. There we go, John. So that was for something different than women's issues and women in science. So, John, can we give out your contact information?
Why don't we wait on that? And there's some things that I'm taking care of right now, but I will get you my contact information. And the other thing that I'm thinking of doing is that if people are interested, they can let Athena know, and I can actually make this lecture that I put together. It's a bunch of PowerPoint slides. I'm willing to let anybody use it that wants to. There's some material in it that is copyrighted, meaning like you can use it for, you probably will be fine to use it for educational purposes, but you wouldn't be able to copy it and say give it out, you know, or anything like that. But if anybody wanted to take a look at it, to look at the actual papers, the references, some of the other information that's there, I'd be glad to do that. The other thing that I'd like to say is that we really, brain size can't be related to intelligence at all, because if you look at Einstein, his brain is actually smaller, even when compared to his body size, than the average woman's brain. And remember, men's brains are much bigger. So that's like sort of anecdotal evidence right there that you really can't correlate brain size to intelligence.
Yes, people have, there's such a hard thing. You know, I thought when they first came out with that, they would say then, just like you said, Neanderthals have been smarter than Homo sapiens. But they just don't seem to, you know, do any critical thinking.
It really is one of these things, I think, Jackie, one of your guests a while back brought up, which is that for us as scientists, we really have to come back to the scientific method, which is, if there is no real significant difference, we really shouldn't be talking about it. We should just say, look, there is no evidence for it. And unfortunately, sometimes we really just get caught up in things like, wow, that's really amazing. It's really different. What does it mean? What does it mean? And instead of saying, I don't know what it means, we have no idea what it means, we're going to have to wait, it's easier to make conjectures, make it sound sexy, get it on the news. And it's just unfortunate that scientists today, I think they do a little bit too much of that. Because unfortunately, it's really hard to get grant money these days. But if your stuff is on the air or sexy or published in the right places or people are talking about it, it's probably going to be easier for you to get money to do your research.
Well, John, I also want to thank you for this article titled Well-Paid Teachers, New York Times article on October 7th. And what I noted was that I want to read a quote here. Now, all of you could access this by going, just Googling Christina, C-H-R-I-S-T-I-N-E, Christine Grallow, G-R-A-L-O-W, New York Times, October 7th, and it'll come up. And it's titled Well-Paid Teachers, and here's a quote. When I see promising teaching colleagues quit because they simply can't afford to live in Manhattan on their salaries, and I see staff shortages and inexperienced teachers at the city's highest need schools, it's clear that a new model is needed. So far this school year, I've seen one good teaching colleague quit to pursue a higher paying job. Teachers realize we're not going to become wealthy when we choose this profession, and low salaries is a way to test for those truly committed to the job. But there's no doubt that low pay also keeps a lot of well-educated, talented Americans out of the classroom. Good teachers also regularly leave the city for higher paying jobs in nearby counties. And low teacher pay has created serious teacher shortage in math, science, and special education, particularly in low-income communities. And this article is about charter schools, I hope people will check that out. And thank you for that, John.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I'm going to say good night to you now and do some housekeeping here, and thank you so very much. I really enjoyed it, and I hope that you got out everything you wanted to, and I know that everyone was really looking forward to it. So good night, John.
Good night.
Well, that was Dr. John Melville and Women in Science, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed having him on. I want to thank Mary Eigner, also our program director here at KZYXNZ, and I want you to check out the documentary Flunked. Just Google Flunked the movie and it will come up. And here's a quote about that. Education reform and school choice have been at the forefront of this year's presidential election. Obama and McCain have different ideas of how to handle the growing crisis in America's education system. While McCain supports school vouchers, Obama does not. But they both agree on the need for more charter schools. Another thing they both agree on, there is a crisis in American education and something must change. So check that out, Flunked the movie. And Education Now programs are featured monthly in the events calendar on the American Montessori Headquarters website and will be now featured in their monthly newsletter. You can access that at amshq.org. That's amshq.org. The AMS 2008 Fall Conference in Garden Grove, California is Montessori Excellence in Action, November 13th through the 16th. Keynote address is Positive Discipline for Developing Capable Young People by Dr. Jane Nelson. Dr. Nelson is the mentor of seven, is the mother of seven and grandmother of 20 children. She's a licensed marriage, family, and child therapist and the author or co-author of 18 books, including several in the Positive Discipline series. Well, on November 20th, here on Education Now at 7 p.m., my guests will be local mentor teachers in the arts of herbs and plants, Donna DeTerra and Mary Pat Palmer. The focus will be herbs and plants during the season of autumn, with activities and suggestions for those who work with children. Okay, well, I want to say to all of you that this is a critical time in education and a critical time for freedom of the press. Education can only take place in a culture that understands the connection between the people and the media. The commercial for-profit media is gobbling up the spectrum, and that is why it is so important that KZYXNZ, Mendocino County's public and community broadcasting station, stay active and alive with international, national, and local voices, as well as this great music they bring you. So please join our community of members by calling CAT at the station at 895-2324 or sign up on the web at www.kzyx.org. Our fall pledge drive here at KZYXNZ will begin this Saturday on October 18th, which is also the birth date of our station. But our silent pledge drive and renewal drive has already begun. So please, help us keep it short and fun. Pledge now, and please be as generous as you can. There are many challenges ahead for this little station. And once again, happy birthday, KZYXNZ. And please, get in your pledges, get them in early, and let's make this pledge drive a fun party for all. All programs aired here on Education Now can be heard and downloaded free at our website, www.pacificsites.com/TildaHermes. If you didn't get that, just Google Melville Montessori School and it will come up. My personal contact is Hermes@pacific.net, and if you have a message for Dr. John, you can send it there, Hermes@pacific.net. Thank you to the producers, the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education. Thank you to the fantastic staff here at the station who are working so hard to bring you this pledge drive and every day. And tune in tomorrow for wonderful Corporations in Democracy. They're going to have Naomi Klein on, and that's at 1 o'clock, so you won't want to miss that. So now, right after Earth and Sky tonight, we're going to have the Treehouse with W. Dan and then Dead Air. It'll either be Muerto Huerto or, you know, I think it's going to be Muerto Huerto, but we'll see. And good night, everyone. And thank you for listening. And thank you to all the members and everyone. And here we go. Let's have some station ID.
You're tuned to KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah, K201 HR 88.1 FM Fort Bragg. Altogether, we're Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, listener-supported community radio. We also stream on the web at kzyx.org. Thanks for listening.